This is the Reading Teachers Lounge, where listeners can eavesdrop on professional conversations between elementary reading teachers. We're passionate about literacy and strive to find strategies to reach all learners. Shannon and Mary are neighbors who realized that they were literacy soul sisters at a dinner in their Atlanta neighborhood. Once they started chatting about reading, they haven't really stopped. Come join the conversation.
Hi, welcome to the Reading Teachers Lounge. This is episode 6 in our 5th season, and this is a special episode of the Reading Teachers Lounge. It's the first one we've done in all of our 5 seasons because Mary and I have asked a listener to come join us, and we've made it more into like a live Reading Teachers Lounge. We met this teacher, Linda, on Instagram, and we started a conversation in the comments a month ago about best practices and sites of reading versus teaching experiences in balanced literacy. And the chat continued in our DMs, and now we've invited Linda on the podcast and into the Reading Teachers Lounge to officially join the conversation with us because we think the direction that our conversation took will be relevant to everyone listening. So before we share the details of the conversation, Linda, and just bring everybody up to speed, can you just introduce yourself and tell us about your teaching experience and the current work you do within the world of literacy?
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm really grateful to be here. I love talking about this stuff, so I'm excited for us to be able to do it live. I'm Linda Ryan. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I have been an educator now for 16 years. I spent 15 of my years in our local school district in Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, taught first grade, fourth grade, reading teacher, literacy facilitator, which is like a literacy coach here. I also spent some time at the district level supporting some of our lowest performing schools, new teachers, and then also helping instructionally in schools K-12. And then had the opportunity to be part of curriculum adoption in our local school district and everything. So it's just been a really great experience. I have a master's in reading, and I am on the science of reading journey, as I call it. Certainly not an expert, but knowledgeable and excited about continuing to learn, which is what I am passionate about in the work that I do. I own my own consulting company now, and I care deeply about helping schools and districts use instructional coaching to leverage literacy outcomes, because I believe that there is power in supporting teachers instructionally and having a supportive lens through instructional coaches as a way of getting those literacy outcomes improved.
Your varied experience is one of the reasons why we asked you to join us for this conversation, Linda, because the title of this episode is How to Balance It All as Reading Teachers. And that's what our Instagram post was about. It's just as reading teachers, we talked about this even in our season opener, where we're put in this place of non-negotiables within our school district, but then also things that we've seen in our own experience that have helped readers in the past. And how do we balance as all as reading teachers? So back in September of 2022, we shared a vulnerable post on Instagram saying that we love science of reading, but we don't hate balanced literacy. And our caption detailed our reasoning behind this statement. Like, a lot of my career was spent in schools where balanced literacy was a non-negotiable, but I kind of snuck in phonics through there. So I never really followed the balanced literacy curriculums with fidelity. But then other times I had more scripted phonics and synthetic phonics programs to follow. And I didn't follow those with fidelity 100% either, because I needed to add some of the more higher level thinking things and the more readers and writers workshop good practices that I learned from the balanced literacy curriculums that I worked with. So no matter which kind of program and curriculum I had, I was never really following them 100%, which I don't know if is good or bad, because we're told to follow them with fidelity, but I just was paying attention to my students' learning and what they needed. And so what I found in my own experience is that teaching reading is an art and a craft, and that we as reading teachers should strike our own balance between the non-negotiables in our school settings and then also the most pressing learning needs of the students in our care. And the way I made sure I did that was to really have a very focused view on data and making sure that my students were mastering the learning objectives. And I took less of a teacher role and more of a facilitator role to make sure that I was using whatever tools available that I had to make sure that the kids were learning. And Linda, I love that she asked for more detail in the comments, and then she sort of pressed me on some things in the DMs. And so she was saying that, like, one of the quotes that really, like, kind of made me stop and think was, you had said, well, what I'm learning is there's a difference between what I believe versus understanding settled science. And that made me question what I was saying was, am I believing that my way is the best? And am I arguing with science of reading when I'm pushing some of the balanced literacy things that I've found to be helpful for students? So you want to kind of delve more into that and what you were meaning?
Yeah. So I think it's part of what makes all of this work difficult, right? When we think about adaptive challenges, which is what we're in right now with a lot of cognitive dissonance, it's really difficult to grapple with the thought that these beloved mentors, beloved professors, people who we love and care for deeply, right? Even people that were writing curriculum that when we read it, we were like, yeah, this really speaks to me, might also not have been serving our students. And so I think that's what I'm finding myself learning and grappling with, is that there is some settled science, scientifically sound research that supports an approach to reading that I wasn't privy to and that I didn't necessarily know. So there's that Maya Angelou quote of know better, do better, that many of us are using to kind of guide where we are, because that's the case for me. You know, I have a master's in reading, but much of that was grounded in approaches that really supported a balanced literacy approach, which again is trying to get at some of the pieces that we see in Scarborough's Rope, in The Simple View of Reading. I mean, when you really delve into those approaches, you see both pieces. It's a both and, right? You can't ignore comprehension as an important component to becoming a reader, but you also can't ignore the importance of explicit systematic phonics and the other foundational skills associated with that in order to build proficient readers. And so that's what I'm finding, is that there's this idea that we just want children to love reading. And I do, right? Of course I do. That's a goal. I have a 7-year-old son. That's what I want for him more than anything. But I'm also learning that what I thought built a love of reading for children might not have been enough. And so I'm having to be a part of that journey in understanding that there is some settled science of reading research out there that I need to be okay with, and, you know, allow myself to let go of what those beloved mentors and professors taught me years ago, to say, like, you know what, they might not have known any better. This might have been what somebody taught them or what they were reading at the time. And now we move on from that. And we say, you know what, that's okay. There's no shame in that. And now we move on and we press forward with the information that we have available. You know, when we think about years ago, neuroscience was not up to snuff. So we have neuroscience now to back up so much of what's being put out there in terms of research. And I can't ignore that, right? But my professors might not have had access to that information either.
I am so pleased with how you phrased that, because I think that it gives a lot of grace to teachers who feel really frustrated, because we should be offering ourselves grace. And I think also extending that to our training, our professional training. I have an example that I've shared previously on the podcast. And when I was just fresh out of my undergrad degree, I also got another degree after about a year of teaching. And the liberal arts college that I went to had a very good teaching program. And I loved my professors dearly. And they were very encouraging of creative practices, of creating thematic units. And that was a really fun experience for me. And when I went in to get my master's degree in special education, I was taught the importance of direct instruction. And that felt so counterintuitive to what I had first learned. And it felt like my creativity was being stifled, and I had to read a script, and any Joe Schmo off the street could just read a script to their students. And I guess I didn't have a solid understanding and trust in the science of reading. And I think that that was what was missing. And you're right, though. It was also very early in the neurological studies, that gap between where the science of what is being studied and then what's being practiced in the classroom was definitely true there. It wasn't until I got into the classroom and I had students who were really struggling, and I realized I did not know how to teach them. And I was teaching kindergarten and we're reviewing letters, and their sounds, and we're trying so hard. And I didn't know what to do. And it wasn't until I did get my Wharton-Gillingham training that I finally felt like, oh, I now know how to teach children to read. So I really appreciate that there should be a little bit of grace in this. And I think that that's where I'm kind of taking a place right now too, because it feels really frustrating in a lot of ways. And I can also appreciate that a lot of teachers feel frustrated when expectations feel very heavy in school. You know, I know that when I was teaching, the expectation of writing lesson plans was extremely important. I spent so much time stressing about my lesson plans that I did not spend enough time questioning the practices and doing all of the really good, important, hard work that it takes to check out what my students really needed at that point and at that time and changing some of my instructional practices. I felt so green about everything and nothing felt right. And so it just felt like you just slug along. You just keep reading. Okay, here's the next unit of study I need to work on. Here's the next one I need to do. Oh, I have a sub that day. Oh, I'm falling back on worksheets because I don't think my substitute is going to be able to handle all of this. So there's a lot that comes along with why teachers are frustrated, I think, with this topic. And I think that Emily Hanford right now has a new podcast called Sold a Story. And it is really breaking into why the science of reading is so important, but it still feels a little bit harsh. And it feels a little like teachers are not doing the best thing that they can for their students. And there are teachers that are admitting, and I am one of those teachers, that there were times where I don't think now, hindsight is 2020, that I was doing what was best for some of those students. And maybe I even harmed them. And that's a big admit. I didn't realize I was doing it at the time. I wasn't doing anything out of malicious practice. But I think there are some gaping wounds that teachers feel about this. And so how do you kind of like walk through this? I think you have to give grace to a lot of people. So I think the way that you describe that is so important. And I think like learning the difference and understanding what is settled science is really important. And being comfortable with sharing that without feeling put upon or that I'm better than you because I know this. I think that some of that language that gets lost in our DMs that way can be really threatening to some people. And walking through this with grace and understanding and recognizing that some people are on different paths and journeys with this, I think that's an approach that I'm really happy to take as well. So thanks so much for sharing that.
Oh gosh. I mean, as a teacher, you give everything to your classroom, right? All you want is to see the children in your classroom succeed. My last class of first graders just graduated high school. And that's all I can think about is, did I do enough? Have I set them on a trajectory for success in life? And especially for teachers who are teaching early literacy, we know the data is there, right? There are prisons being built based on early reading data. We know it's an equity issue that sets children on a path to success in life. So the stakes are incredibly high and teachers know it. And that's all that they want. So the idea that you now have learned something that says a message to you as a teacher, like, you might have been harming children unintentionally, is the most devastating thing to hear as a teacher. And I think until we recognize that and create a space that is safe enough for teachers to have that kind of conversation, you're not going to see a giant shift to practices that will actually support children, because it's too scary as a teacher to admit that the practices you might have been using could be not preparing students for success, because that's all we want.
Can you describe some of those practices? Like, what is like bringing up those feelings of shame for people? What is Emily Hanford calling out as, you know, not good enough now that we know more of subtle science?
Sure. So the big thing right now, right, is the three cueing approach as a theory of reading to support how we learn to read, right? So the three cueing approach really rests on using meaning and structure with some visual support as the way that children learn to read. So in the three cueing approach, meaning is the focus, which of course is the focus. That's the point of reading, right? We want to walk away from text with meaning. But what we have learned from DeHaene's study of the reading brain is that the way that we become proficient at reading is when we make those sound spelling connections first, because we're neurologically wired to learn oral language first, right? It's why kids start babbling at a young age and everything. And so then we have to teach children that we have letters and graphemes and combinations of letters that represent those sounds that we're hearing. And then we tie all of that to meaning, right? So it flips three cueing on its head by really focusing and putting decoding first, whereas three cueing is asking kids, what do you think goes here, right? Which is why predictable texts like leveled readers that lean on picture cues are so important to that approach, because the children haven't necessarily learned those sound spelling patterns that support them with decoding those more difficult words. And so looking at the four-part processing model is a new way for those who have been leaning on three cueing. It's a new way, but it also flips it on its head. So it's hard to grapple with, right? And in some ways, three cueing feels right, because we do want readers to come away with meaning, right? We do want readers to have enough understanding of language structures that they can grapple with an unknown word and think, what's the part of speech here? Well, I know I'm going to need a verb. Let me think about a verb that makes sense in this sentence. So that's why this is hard, right? Because we do want that. We do need to go there at some point, right? We need to build those structures. But three cueing minimizes decoding as an approach for early readers. And I think that's where it gets hard.
If you don't mind, I want to add on to this a little bit too, sure. Because something that I learned through this journey of mine, but also this is specific from Emily Hanford's most recent podcast, is that when you're first looking at children who are doing this three coding method, they tend to be more successful in the early stages. And so if you're observing students who are reading, then you're going to see that they are making progress. And a lot of children do make faster progress, but people who were taught to focus on this type of cueing system and were not necessarily taught to focus just on the letters and the sounds, and they actually use a different neural network to read. And that network is not as efficient or helping map those written words into your memory. And so what that happens then is that you see a lot of really early progress with children who use three cueing, but then they're not as able to third, fourth, and fifth grade actually map as many words as other students. So this is where this breakdown of like, oh, did I actually harm kids in making them not as efficient in their reading practices kind of comes into play. And so this is really kind of a tricky thing. So I don't ever remember being told that I was doing anything wrong. Or if I was doing this, at least I'm doing a little bit of phonics instruction. I'm still teaching this specifically, so I'm doing the right thing. And it does feel right. But now the science is clear. And so now we have to really kind of look at this in a different way. And I think first and foremost, we feel like it's fear that we did something wrong. And most teachers are absolutely not trying to do anything wrong. They are very like, let's follow the script. Let's do everything right the first time. I never want to get in trouble type of people. So it does feel really tricky to start this off this way. So anyway, I wanted to just kind of add that, because that's definitely something that struck a chord with me when I was first reading about this.
Mary, do you remember when Wally Blevins was on our podcast last year? Which I love just name dropping that and saying that because he's my guru. But anyway, he said that the books that we give the readers purposely build that path they're going to use as readers down the line. And if we're giving them those predictable books over and over and over, like you said, we're building that more inefficient path. But when we're giving them the just decodable books, we're building that more efficient path, which just we're going to be doing more episodes very soon in the near future about the reading brain and about how the brain stores words and about decodable text. So I'm just going to touch on those here, but keep in mind, listeners, that more will be coming. But I just remembered what he had said about that book choice and how important it is, because that is literally teaching the students what they're going to be doing and creating those behaviors long term.
I think, too, something that you both touched on is spending time building students' foundational skills at the early level is an investment in their long game in reading, which I think is really important for literacy leaders to hear too, or school leaders, district leaders to hear, because that's hard. It's hard to be patient to reap the benefits of that, especially when it feels slow moving and when you've been using a process that seems to be successful quickly. And so I think too, that's a really important takeaway to remember, that you have to continue to be a diagnostic and changing what your measure of success is. And also knowing that if you're going to make an investment in early reading in your K-2 levels, which often are not being measured in your high stakes tests, right, for state testing, that you need to play the long game there and be willing to wait to see the evidence of that, while also addressing current gaps for the students who may have missed what you might now be implementing. And so if you're not taking an approach that helps students in your upper grades have some intervention support and some of that foundational skill work that they need, you will have to wait kind of a while to see evidence of that show up.
I love what you just said about changing your measure of success. And that was reminding me of this teacher I worked with, Carrie Carter. She was the best kindergarten teacher at foundational skills. She nailed down the phonemic awareness with the kids. She built sound symbol mapping. She helped the kids build alphabetic principle and sound symbol correspondence. And I could look at a fourth or fifth grader and know that they were in her kindergarten class before I looked at their permanent record. I could look at their reading and know that they were in her class. And I was right like 95% of the time. But how do we have that patience? I mean, like, schools don't have that patience to wait. And then how can we measure, if it's a longer success gain, how can we measure the short-term gain so we still feel like we know that we're doing the right thing? Like, even if we can't move the kids through the levels A, B, C, D, and those guided reading levels, because they're getting a little bit better at reading some of the sight words, and they're getting a little bit better at predicting, maybe using the first letter that they can guess the picture and be able to figure out those words, but they're not necessarily decoding the difference between horse and pony or something. We've seen that example on YouTube. So what can we do as little steps to know that we're doing the right thing as schools and as teachers?
Well, I think what you need to look at is, what are your assessments asking of students? And do the skills that you're using in your assessments measure what you are now teaching, right? At some point, leveled text becomes decodable, but only when you've given students the exposure to the sound spelling correspondences that show up in those texts, right? So if all you have are leveled readers, I always encourage people to do a decodability test on the leveled text and determine, what skills do students need to be able to access the words in this text? Which words would I not expect them to be able to read? And what am I going to do to support them with that? Am I going to encourage them to look at the picture, or am I going to have them identify the sounds they might know in the word and help them with the rest, right? Because that's a way of using the heart word strategy, right? Because the heart is that they haven't learned that sound yet, right? And at some point it will become decodable.
And that's a way to use the resources and not just throw them away.
For sure.
As you've learned more.
For sure. But two, you know, there are cadence assessments, which are Bibles assessments. Those help teachers get to a diagnostic level on discrete skills that are needed at the foundational skill level, for teachers to kind of be examining, what is my data telling me? And can I measure success on proficiency with these foundational skills? And that's just an example. There's many other assessments that align. And the PAST is out there for measuring phonemic awareness. You know, there's lots out there that I think aligns a little bit better to what you're aiming for. So I think that's the first question is, you might be switching instruction, but if your assessments don't change, you're going to keep circling back to what you used to do. So you have to look for an alignment between both your instruction and your assessments in order for change to happen, because you need your data to back up the instructional decisions that you're going to be making. I forgot the rest of your question, so we'll just keep going.
No, well, I wanted something, Mary?
I do, because I think the other piece that I see is especially when you are a teacher, and I don't want to say that like you are a young teacher, if you are inexperienced in the grade level that you have maybe just recently switched to, and you are just not as familiar with, you know, all of the standards in, let's say you've moved from first grade to third grade, there's still a lot of phonemic information that has to still be taught in third grade that if you are a current first grade teacher, you just may not be as familiar with teaching the morphology, making sure that students really understand schwa sounds, making sure that they're doing some higher level phonics decoding and taking more of a deep dive and maybe making that as a one of your non-negotiables, something that you're going to really improve upon. That might be a better start, because I found that when I had to switch from grade level to grade level, it became really overwhelming content-wise for me. And I think that I had to just really rely so much on curriculum or whatever. And the students would ask me a question. I felt like there were times where I just had to like brush it away and I didn't get a chance. So I would say, just take a big zoom out and say, okay, where are my areas of weakness? Where can I improve upon? And not that you have to keep juggling everything and add one more ball, but maybe set one thing down, pick up a new thing and get a little bit better or improve in it that way. Because I think that's another area, is that teachers are expected, especially in those early grade levels, to cover a lot of content. And kindergarten phonemic awareness, especially, is like a great example. Being really strong in teaching phonemic awareness takes a lot of work on the part of the teacher, a lot of observation, a lot of making sure that students are knowing what to do. If you are moving from fifth grade to kindergarten, that's a pretty big leap when you're trying to like invest in this. So I think part of it is really being comfortable with your content. And that's, I just wanted to touch on that.
Well, I think that harkens back to what we were talking about a little bit before we started recording on kind of what's the purpose of a curriculum, right? And for me, I feel like a curriculum should serve the teacher and serve the students. And when a teacher has to supplement 90% of the curriculum, then the curriculum's not doing its job, right? Because it's meant to provide the minimal level of instruction that we would expect to see happening in that classroom, regardless of the teacher that's in there, right? Many schools right now, many districts have a goal of having a guaranteed and viable curriculum because that's what our kids deserve. It's the equitable way to approach instruction for children. And so one reason I think that's so important is because teachers have been using curriculum that doesn't serve them. So they have spent their years of experience figuring out how to become curriculum designers in addition to being teachers. And we haven't necessarily had background in that. We're just showing up because that's what teachers do, right? So if we wanted to shift to being ready to use a curriculum, I think one thing that needs to shift with it is helping teachers understand how to use a curriculum and see themselves in it or add themselves to it, right? The curriculum helps us with what and sometimes how, but I would rather see a teacher, instead of spending all of their time outside of teaching, designing lessons, searching for lessons, spend time reading the curriculum that they've been provided and thinking about the data that they have in front of them with their kids and how they help make this curriculum relevant for the people in their classroom.
I mean, I think you described what I did, I guess, in my second grade classroom, is I was in a units of study school. I was in a LLI, that those were the books I had for my guided reading. I wove my structured phonics into the units of study when I was teaching my encoding lessons with writing. And then I used LLI books more as decodables than predictable text. But that was because I brought my own knowledge to it. But what if teachers don't have that control yet of their own curriculum? So what if someone is being mandated to use these resources? And do they need to get more PD to learn more about science of reading? Do they just pay attention to their learning and the students learning or not learning, and then also pay attention to their own gut and realize, wait, something's not working here and I need to do more?
There's another layer in this, and this is why I was so resistant early on to doing like a direct instruction approach, is because I didn't want to just read a script. My students need to know that I am there with them and I'm being authentic and this is part of me. So if I barely have time to prepare before my lesson and I am reading the script as it goes, I don't feel like I'm being as authentic with my students, and I don't think that they respond to me either. So yeah, there's lots of layers. So go ahead, Linda. This is big.
So this is hard, right? Especially depending on your level of experience and how loud your voice is or what your comfort level is with being the squeaky wheel. So first and foremost, teachers need to do what some of what they're being asked, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that they can't question it, nor does it mean that they can't use the strategies that they might have been exposed to or be learning within a framework that they're being asked to use, right? So let's just say that you are a teacher who has knowledge of some of the science of reading practices that you want to make sure are being put in front of your students, but you're working within a balanced literacy framework. Well, a piece of balanced literacy is a focus on word work, right? So why can't there be a scope and sequence and some explicit systematic instruction that's happening during that time for your students, right? That certainly would align to an expectation of working within a balanced literacy framework. You know, if leveled readers is all you have, you can choose leveled readers that align to said scope and sequence that you have used to outline what your word work time is. You might choose to make sure that you're spending time developing text sets to guide your read aloud time based on the science and social studies standards that are aligned to what your state is expecting of students, because that will help you build knowledge and spend time building the vocabulary, getting deep with kids, which we know is needed, right? Because it's not just, we're not just talking about the foundational skills, there's more at play. So if you are having to do a read aloud time, choose a text that supports students building knowledge deeply about something that you might already be studying. So to me, that's a way of figuring out where are the connections between what I'm being asked to do and what I'm learning. I think too, one thing that I share with everybody is, and especially those new teachers that I used to support, is your voice matters, whether you come with years of experience or not. And so when you find yourself in a planning session, you deserve to ask questions or share some things that you are learning, because there's a reason you were hired. There's a reason that you're there. You have a seat at the table. So when you choose not to use that seat, when you choose not to lift your voice, right, then you're acknowledging that you don't matter as a professional, which I don't think that that's true. Now, we all know there's, you got to navigate some tricky PLCs and teams and things like that, right? So I'm not saying that, but I think it's okay to be the squeaky wheel at times and to have a professional conversation with the leaders that you have access to. Share resources, share your excitement, and say things like, you know, I was listening to this podcast. I would love to have somebody else to talk about it. Have you listened to it? Like, would you be willing to listen to it and be my thought partner on this? That's a very safe way of approaching someone and saying, like, I'm just dying to talk to somebody about this.
I'm so glad that you're giving our listeners permission for that, because I do think that sometimes people do need permission to do that. And I also teach my students every time I'm with them that the smartest people ask questions in the room. And being able to think deeply about something means that you are 100% in it and you are committed to whatever you're doing. And if you're committed to it, then asking questions should be an okay thing. And then if the answers are not provided right away, who is a thought partner? Who is a person who can be the liaison or the bridge to get you to the answer? That's the most important part. And I also like that you said, you know, you were hired for a reason. Your school does find you valuable. And I think that there are some teachers who are feeling threatened or vulnerable or whatever that might be the case in this at this time, especially younger teachers. I hear that often from them too. Asking questions is just the beginning, I would say.
I would I want to add to that a very specific example from my second grade experience at my previous school. I would say ask questions framed around the kids' learning. So we used to have these grade level meetings where we were giving like weekly assessments based on different reading skills. And so we would have to get together. One of our meetings every week was about planning. Another week meeting each week was about looking at the data. And so we would look at the data on this little 10 question quiz. And we would say, okay, how many kids got question 7 wrong? How many kids got question 6 wrong? Blah, blah, blah. Okay. So I started asking questions like, okay, question 6 was about main idea. Did they get main idea wrong because they don't understand main idea or because they couldn't read the passage because we have 50% of our second graders reading on a kindergarten or first grade level? And that, honestly, that squeaky wheel like really made my team angry. Like, and even the instructional coach was like, we don't have time to answer that question, Miss Betts. Like, I just want to know how many of your kids got question 6 wrong and let's move on. And so then I like at least went in my own classroom and looked at my own students' data and looked at who missed question 6. And I could see a difference between someone who had failed that 10 question test with 20% versus 70%. That 70% score, even though it was a failing score, that child was an almost reader and needed more comprehension support versus that 20%. And I had running records that showed that they couldn't read that passage. And so then I needed to give them a passage on the level that I was working on them with, and then see if they could do main idea there. And at least that would tell me more about the comprehension than just they got this question wrong.
I was your instructional coach. Shout out to Angela, because I was that instructional coach for a hot second. And I will never forget, I so appreciated the teacher who pushed back on me and said, I know I have students who are not decoding this grade level passage yet. And I need to know if what I've been teaching them in terms of being able to understand how to identify main idea, et cetera, makes sense to them, right? Like, I need to understand if they're understanding what we ask of them in terms of language comprehension, right? We weren't using that terminology, but that's what she was getting at. And I will never forget, I said, we certainly, I mean, sounds like we were a little bit different, right? But sometimes you're pressured for time. Sometimes you're just like, oh my gosh, like we can't deviate from the agenda that I put together because, oh my gosh, like time is of the essence. But you were such an important person. And I think you did the right thing. Like, you went back and you explored that question for yourself, right? And sometimes the data talks. Sometimes that is the answer. If you're getting the pushback and you're not getting a thought partner in your current situation, sometimes you do just need to do what's happening for your classroom and support your students. And at some point, your data will make other people ask questions.
And once my data was good enough, they were kind of like, you know what, Miss Betts, you get the results so you can go in your room and do what you need to do. Like, just kind of don't waste our time in the grade level meetings with all your words. But I hated that it was only in my room because like I had second grade peers who were like, I'm not going to teach phonics. If they didn't learn it in first grade and they came to me not knowing how to read, then that's not my problem.
That's a really common thing that a lot of people say. It is frustrating because I think that's the other thing, is that teachers feel such a time crunch and we have to get this done and everything is goal bound. And, you know,
we feel pressured to teach the standards of our grade level.
Well, and that's what I was going to get at too. So in special ed, especially when you're writing IEP goals, everything has to be tied to grade level standards, which is not necessarily wrong. We don't want to be teaching lower. We want to set strong expectations for our students. But again, same thing. How many times have I written a goal that's based on comprehension? And instead of saying instructional text based on the student's instructional ability level, they're reading a grade level text. Or how do I know that they're understanding main idea if they can't understand what they're reading at an independent level? So I'm right there with you. So I just wanted to tie that back too, because when you are writing goals, it is essential to really think about each and every single word that you're putting in that goal. And so whether we're talking about children who have special needs or your grade band in general, we need to be really careful about how we're examining those skills.
Because you're talking about understanding the learning goals. Like, what are the learning goals as the classroom teacher or the special ed teacher or the tutor or whomever?
I think too, it's important to recognize when, like, we also don't want students to be stuck in instructional level text purgatory, right? Where they're never going to grow. And so
let's say the goal is asking students to lift to the level of grade level text. Do I, as a teacher, have the skills and understanding and strategies of appropriate scaffolds that help get a child there, right? Am I so focused on them being able to decode it versus what would happen if I read the text aloud to them and they could respond to the comprehension questions, right? Have I spent time delving into some of the vocabulary that they need to be able to access this text with some pre-teaching? Do they have access to the background knowledge to access the text? And I think too, there's some of that at play in what you were saying about the second grade teacher saying, like, they didn't come to me knowing how to do this, right? So when I hear that from a coaching lens, I wonder if that person says that because they know that they don't have the skills or that content knowledge as a teacher to teach what's missing in the foundational skill gap for those students, right? I sometimes wonder if it's a defense mechanism to not reveal the fact that I don't actually know how to help a child who comes to me with a lack of skills.
It could be because we have a wide lens because all three of us talking are reading specialists and we've worked with readers at every single grade level. So I can meet a third grader and know after doing a running record what they're missing from first grade and what they're missing from kindergarten and what they're missing from third grade. But if you haven't had that whole wide variety of that grade level experience, you might not know.
I know people are exhausted with the idea that we are talking about this pandemic having an impact on students too. But I think that middle school teachers are experiencing this at a really strong degree. So I think something that we should talk about is, okay, how do we approach that as a question? How do we ask our administrators to help support us this way? How do we ask our instructional coaches to help support our learners this way? So my first would be, I'm noticing that there is something going on with my learners. I have a third of my class and I feel like they are having difficulty decoding. What can I do to support?
And you bring that data, you bring that running record to show this child cannot sound out the word fantastic, you know, which is all closed syllables or something, right?
Yeah. So that's actually some of the work that I've done with David and Meredith Lieben. They have a course through Achieve the Core called Improving Reading for Older Students. And I will say the thing to leverage that we talk about in that course is building a student's fluency. So when we think about the goals of reading as students get older, it really is to start diving into the content of what we're learning from the text, right? Especially in the middle school and high school level. We think about disciplinary literacy, right? We want students to be able to read a science text and understand the discipline that they're in terms of that content area. And so we talk a lot about leveraging fluency as an approach to support students with getting there, right? So we might not always be able to fill all of the decoding skill gaps that students have at that point. And oftentimes the systems in place at middle school are not there to support that either, and have maybe an intervention time for students to teach them those foundational skills. So there are things that core teachers can do in putting some fluency supports in place with those core texts that they know students need to be able to access, right? Using audiobooks, getting partners reading together, letting students read chunks of text repeatedly and breaking it down kind of in a way of using close reading, but chunking it with fluency as a goal can actually be a way that then helps students get to the level of reading comprehension that we want them to with some of those advanced texts.
I'm going to add to explicitly teaching in some executive functioning skills too, because when students, especially middle school, this really kind of comes into play. But that advanced planning, initiating the task and making sure that they can pause and think, okay, I've just read this text. Now, what am I supposed to be thinking about the text? Not just the act of decoding it, but you may really need to be very explicit with your learners about what they need to be asking themselves and modeling that text. And you may think, oh, well, they should have gotten this in third grade and fourth grade. And that's okay. Students, sometimes it comes in one ear and out the other. And you may teach something one day and the next day they cannot replicate that task. And that does not necessarily have to do with the fault of the teacher. And I think that's something else that we need to do. We need to hand the learning to the students and make students responsible for their learning, but we cannot just do that. It has to be a scaffolded process. Even for some of our brightest learners, this is still a struggle. So you need to meet students where they are on these types of tasks and figure out, okay, what are the skills that are missing? You may have a student who can decode and decode and decode. They could be a first grader. They still don't know how to pause and think about what they have read or predict what the next question would be. So all of this is so important, and teachers do wear many, many hats, but sometimes that's like the questions that you could ask. Okay, what are my students missing? Well, have I taught the executive functioning skills that are needed for this task? If that's a takeaway that you take today, great. Even if it's just initiating the task, great, take that. Maybe it's planning a step-by-step. What are the next three things I need to do? Can I restate the beginning, middle, and end of a story? Oftentimes, students don't just take that learning on their own.
Yeah, I completely agree, right? It's the both and. It's all of the pieces of the language comprehension strands of the reading rope and the word recognition strands of the reading rope. And we know those have to be woven together in order to create proficient reading with automaticity, right? So certainly figuring out what strand I'm addressing with a child is crucial in terms of improving instruction for a child who maybe isn't quite at that automatic level that you're looking for. And we know texts increase in complexity over time, right? You need different skills to read a Harry Potter book than you do a Shakespeare, right? You need different skills to read one of those texts versus, you know, the US Constitution. So that also comes into play. You might be a fluent reader in fourth and fifth grade and find yourself non-fluent as the text complexity increases. So that's something else for teachers to keep in mind too, is like, what is this text asking of a reader? And have I supported them with the skills that they need to access it?
So what is our responsibility as reading teachers? I mean, what are we supposed to do? How do we do a balance at all? Like, how do we look at curriculum, whatever school setting we're in? How do we look at our learners? Like, how do we piece it all together and make it make sense for us and for our students?
I think this is a really important question. Number one, I think all teachers are reading teachers. So I know that we're in our reading teachers lounge right now, right? But even if you are a teacher who is departmentalized at your school and you are only teaching math and science, you have an opportunity to support students' literacy. Whether that is helping them decode word problems in math, helping them access a text in science, I think that's key to remember, is that we all have an opportunity to support students' literacy. And if we don't have the skills to do that, or we don't understand how to approach that, finding the people, finding the resources to help us do that, looking at our practitioners in our schools, speech language pathologists, our special ed teachers who know how to do explicit instruction, finding the people who have been trained in some of the practices like Orton-Gillingham or people who have been through letters training, asking questions of those people to help us build our skills is everyone's responsibility. But I think if you're a reading teacher and that is your only assignment, I think you need to be a critical consumer, right? I think it's one of the most important things you need to do. And it's one of the most important things I've learned on this journey, right? Because I kind of blindly believed and followed what I was taught, right? And I was not necessarily looking at what I was learning through a critical lens. And I wasn't necessarily searching for multiple viewpoints to help me land on where I needed to be, which means I was letting someone else's bias on what they were putting in front of me dictate what I used in my instructional practices. So I think that that's key in deciding what we're going to do, right? I would ask myself, am I only seeing one viewpoint to guide where I'm going next? And have I looked for what others are saying to then decide what is right for my students? And two, what is my data telling me? Does my data match what the national data looks like? Am I okay with 60% proficiency in reading, right? And for many years, like, I was okay with that, right? Because I was doing everything I could and everything I knew at the time.
And so I had to be okay with that because I was doing everything I could, right? But I think that's my other question is, as a reading teacher, are you measuring what you want to be measuring? And is it really giving you the data points that's telling you whether your students are successfully reading, or do they just look like readers?
Awesome. I mean, I totally agree so much. I mean, I remember early in my career thinking, I don't know, are all my kids in my classroom going to read? Such an obscure idea. But then when it really counted and I really had a non-reader sitting in front of me, I was so frustrated. I was just like, I don't know what to do. And I think when you get to that point, you either dig in if you have the time, ability, and space to do that, or you have to pass it on because time is of the essence too. And I want to make sure that we are doing what's right by all students. And the science says almost every person can learn to read. Almost every person can learn to read. And Shannon and I started this because we knew that we could teach readers to become better readers, but we were having a really hard time teaching children to be readers if they had limited abilities. And so we want to talk about this. And I have to say, your perspective is so kind and so generous and refreshing because it doesn't rely on this reading wars topic. We don't need to do that. We are really all in this together. And I think that having discussions like this that are safe, encouraging, and a bit challenging and stretching, I think that this is how we make big changes. So thank you so much for your time, Linda. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, Linda, on her comments on Instagram, like at one point, she could tell I was getting nervous. And she's like, don't worry, I'm not a troll. Like, you literally use those words because I think you could tell I was nervous saying, like, it's scary to even say I like some things about balanced literacy. Like, that felt very vulnerable and that I was going to get attacked. Going back to what you were saying, Linda, I think that the reading teachers need to understand what is reading mean at each of their levels too. Like, when I was teaching second grade, that meant decoding all the words because you had taught all the vowel sounds at that point and you had taught, you know, the syllable types and you had taught the high frequency words. And so can they decode that text? But then they can they begin to get some meaning from what they've decoded. But then when you get to the upper grades, then reading looks a little different because it's not just can they decode it, but are they reading to learn from that text? Are they having a deep inferential meaning and catching all the little nuances of language that the author has put in there and following the dialogue of the chapter book? And, you know, every reading teacher needs to understand what good reading looks like at their level to then be able to gauge, am I preparing all my kids to read?
Yeah. And I think that's key, right? Like, not only what good reading looks like, but are my students actually doing it, right? And I think there's a shift that happens in that second, third grade timeframe, right? We were used to that phrase of learning to read and reading to learn, right? But two, like, we read to learn in our younger grades. It's just with support from somebody else who's helping us access the high quality above grade level text that's helping us build that knowledge and have those discussions, right? And then that responsibility of reading shifts a little bit more to the student as they get older, once they've developed some of those skills. Certainly.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was a lesson I was doing with my sixth graders. I had done one last week. They were reading Emperor's New Clothes because we were doing point of view of different characters. And I thought that was a good story to use for that. And I did not provide enough support. Like, I modeled point of view with another story. And then I kind of gave them the story and was like, go for it. Try to figure out these different characters' point of view. And nobody was laughing while they were reading the text. Like, so I could tell they didn't understand that the emperor was naked, you know, because that's a story that gets reaction from middle schoolers, you know? And so I redid the lesson and I did more shared reading and support. And we broke it down paragraph by paragraph. And I did more language support and just gave a lot more scaffolds until they could really understand the text. But then I told them at the end, I said, it's your responsibility as a reader to notice when you're not getting it. Like, I forced y'all to read this passage again, but I want you to turn on that lens for yourself, because your level, that is what the authors are expecting you to do. And the teacher isn't going to hold your hand all the time like they did in the early grades and say, are you getting this? Are you getting this? Do you understand every part? Like, you have to start paying attention to when that meaning is breaking down.
That's a perfect example of noticing that the executive functioning of taking on that metacognition, the responsibility, you know, that they don't have ownership in it yet. And I think that if you're noticing that ownership is an issue, then go to executive functioning skills, because I do think that that's really kind of a unique place. Do they know how to initiate the task? Do they understand the step-by-step process? Can they evaluate what's happening at that time? And, you know, executive functioning is this big umbrella term. There are lots of terms that fall under it. But what it ultimately means is, can they do it on their own? Can they do it on their own? And are they getting it done? And your answer was no. So you did have to kind of go back and redo it. But I love that you explicitly told the students what the expectation should be and how you go back and do that. So I think that, again, that's another really great example of just making sure that you're making it as apparent as possible for your students. Some really need that right now.
Well, because the goal of that passage was understanding, and they didn't have that. And I don't think the students even realized. I think they're missing that as a class, that the purpose of reading is understanding. So like, I'm going to have to work on that enduring understanding with them and not just recalling the words.
There's something to be said too about the approach you used in giving them the opportunity to grapple with it themselves and have some productive struggle, and then being prepared with how you're going to respond when they're not showing you what your target was for the lesson, which I think sometimes gets lost, right? We dive in with the scaffolds first. We don't necessarily always believe that our students can do it, so we keep them from trying. So I appreciate that. But I also think it highlights the skill that you have in knowing how to be responsive in the moment, right? So if you're a teacher listening and you might not be at that skill level yet, spending time planning ahead for how am I going to respond when this falls flat, right, could be key to also then being prepared to support students and be successful.
I have to also add on the fact that I love that you used the same text and repeated the lesson again, because there's a lot to be said too about repeating text and making sure that, okay, students have already had a chance to grapple with the decoding piece. Now they're more comfortable with it. Now we can add on and we can talk about another layer. So I do want to also encourage teachers too, if that's not a practice that you're comfortable with, it's something to I definitely encourage too, is using repeated text, because it takes off the pressure for some of your students too.
Well, it's a teacher with just a few years experience that I'm co-teaching with in that class. And I mean, I had kind of had to justify it coming back a little bit to him. But I said, look, I can't move on from this text. Like, I think they need to see that it's not okay to read this text and just lose the whole meaning of it, that we can provide the support and we can grapple with it. And I wish y'all had been there. Like, it was so fun when the kids started to understand it. And then, you know, they got in a debate if they were going to tell the emperor if he was naked, or if they would keep up with the ruse and the scam, and if the thieves were doing a good job being scammers or not. I mean, it was really fun once they got the text. And I was showing them that too, that the text is fun, you know, like once you get the meaning of it, it means something, you know? So, I think the reason I'm doing that is because my experience, I mean, I really don't call myself a reading teacher. Like, I feel like I'm more a facilitator of learning, but that has come through experience. And I don't know, that's one of the reasons I was asking you these things on social media, Linda, is because like, am I a rebel or am I doing the right thing when I don't follow these curriculums with fidelity? And I'm kind of doing my own like unique Miss Betz reading teaching, because it's been 20 years of experience of all these different tools. But then is that a good thing or a bad thing? And then it's not right to expect a beginning teacher to do that. I don't know. It's just, I'm trying to just understand if I'm doing the right thing always or not. And I know every teacher's thinking that.
I really think it depends. You know, as you said, when a curriculum has been chosen, I think number one, it's understanding why it was chosen. What purpose does it serve? What kind of, you know, support is it providing students? Is it supporting the data that we're looking to have from students? And, you know, when we think back to what I was saying about having an equitable approach, right, we want to know there's a minimum expectation of what we want to see instructionally. And so a curriculum can help provide that. Whereas, again, if a teacher is completely supplementing what's being done, they look at the learning target and they're like, oh, I know how to teach this, right? One thing I've found is, or we skip the lesson, right? Like my students are got that or whatever. What I've found is we sometimes miss the point of why a lesson was put in that place, a part of that approach and instruction. And again, because we are not the curriculum designers, right? We're the curriculum implementers. And so sometimes in the beginning, we have to put our trust in implementing with fidelity so that we understand the entire scope of how this curriculum is supposed to play out before we start making decisions about moving away from fidelity and instead with integrity. And that's what we have found locally. You know, when we went through our curriculum adoption, the ask was start with fidelity and be ready to move to integrity, right? But you can't get to integrity without first having fidelity and understanding how the curriculum is meant to show up. If you just decide before you even implement it, then who's to say whether the curriculum is doing its job or not, right? And are you helping the district or your school who's chosen this curriculum make the decision 5 years down the road to continue the curriculum or not, right? It's difficult then to say if the curriculum is serving what it needs.
It makes me wonder because I know some schools, like units of study, it was adopted heavily in New York City public schools. And we know that it's a high poverty area. There's probably a lot of struggling readers up there. It has been successful in some schools. Were they doing kind of the unique mixture like I was doing and layering extra pieces on top of it or not? So that's a question, you know, that we kind of, you almost need to look at the case by case basis. But what's the difference between fidelity and integrity in what you're saying? Like, so fidelity is doing it exactly as prescripted and as described.
Right. So fidelity is implementing it kind of the way it's written, right? You might picture that more like following the script. Integrity leaves a little bit more wiggle room for making some instructional decisions, right? Or shifting around maybe some of the time expected in a lesson, recognizing that there's a different approach that your students maybe needed when you did this with fidelity last year. So how do I need to scaffold this differently than what's written in the curriculum? Or I know my students need a little bit more independent time or practice with this particular skill. So we're going to add another lesson or another day to the lesson that gives it more time. So that's kind of moving away from fidelity and more into integrity because you as a team or a school are starting to make some instructional decisions about, okay, we tried this last year. This is how it landed. And we learned some things from that.
I would say that's what I did with units of study because year one, I did follow it very closely to how it was in there. And then the more I learned about it, the more I realized that Lucy had said, well, this isn't really a script. I'm just giving you a glimpse into this writing teacher's classroom. I mean, if you had come in year two, year three, you could tell I was still doing units of study. The big pieces were there. But like you said, I did layer in extra things and extra lessons for some of my students. Some other students I accelerated, some other students I scaffolded and said, you know what, they don't need to be doing a 3-paragraph small moment story. I'm going to work on sentence level with them and so forth, at least the first semester, and then hopefully get them to that higher level by second semester.
I want to go back to something that you said too about where curriculum is being implemented, right? So the other question is, who's also supporting what's happening for students, right? So who has enough privilege and wealth to support tutoring services outside of school that then helps develop readers? So I think that's another question that sometimes is left unanswered is it the school that's teaching children how to read, or is it the outside supports, the people who can pay for explicit instruction and tutoring and that type of thing?
The program might have gotten the credit when necessarily it wasn't.
Tough to say.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that's another reason sometimes for some fidelity to curriculum implementation is the district who has invested in this curriculum is trying to answer that question. And so when we don't support that, we don't get a clear picture on what was actually helping implement change.
I see that all the time with the students that I'm making. So I think also putting back on tutors and families just a bit too, make sure that you let your school district know that you're doing this. Like when I have students who are in an IEP meeting with me and I am very explicit about the fact that they get this amount of tutoring from me every week and take explicit notes too. And then finally, the other thing I wanted to kind of touch on was just that with fidelity and making sure that parents are understanding this too. Lucy, Emily Hanford recommends this teaching 100 spelling lessons. What's it called?
Teaching your kid to read in 100 DC lessons.
Thank you. Okay. So I have a lot more expertise, but I also note, I think what I've read actually is the reason that she is also encouraging this is because she is having some parents who are reading her articles who are saying, oh my goodness, this is not happening. I see this in my child. What am I going to do? I cannot afford to hire a tutor. I know that something needs to be done. She's trying to give a resource to parents. It is not my number one recommended resource I would like to share. What I would like to say to parents is if you have a lot of questions about this kind of stuff, reach out to specialists, reach out to the teachers at your school, see if teachers are willing to tutor at a discounted price. Not that I'm also advocating for that because teachers need to know their worth. There are lots of things. I think that it can be a resource for some families, but it may not work if your child struggles with more serious issues such as dyslexia. So I just like to make that statement too. And I would not recommend using that particular book in a classroom setting at all.
I had to use it in a classroom. Well, that program based by the same author in a classroom setting, and it did not build metacognition. It had built word recognition, but it ignored all the other parts of the Scarborough's reading rope. So it's one, it's sort of science of reading informed, but doesn't have all the pieces. I would say both of y'all were just talking about, like, if you're not following something with fidelity, it needs to be documented at least. And I did do that with my lesson plans. And I did, like, I even knew the literacy coordinator for my district. And I was telling her, I'm layering on my own phonics based on Wiley Blevins. And, you know, I'm not following the recommended scope and sequence that goes with LLI because it doesn't actually follow the decodability of the texts that are in order. So it doesn't make sense to me. And I was prepared to handle the consequences for not following it with fidelity, because I have had administrators where they've said, you know, if you don't follow with non-negotiables, like, you are going to be written up. And I was prepared for that. But I feel so strongly about advocating for the learning of my kids that, okay, I'm going to do what's right for their learning and I'll deal with it. And then luckily my data matched what my gut and my experience had told me that they were going to learn to read with the instructional decisions I made. And then the pressure got less, but the documentation is important.
This has been an amazing chat.
We could keep you on here forever, but I know the listeners are going to maybe be done.
They're going to be fading
fast. And they're going to be at school by now and wanting this chat to be over. So Linda, is there anything else you want to say while we have you on air? And then also I want you to tell people where they can meet you online, because I know they're going to want to learn more from you.
Sure. I care so deeply about approaching this with a sense of grace. And I want teachers to know that I believe that they are allowed to be professionals in the decisions that they make, and that being that critical consumer, asking questions, being an advocate in the space that you take up is important, whether that's just in your classroom with a team or in your school or district level. You know, so certainly find the other people that you need who can be your thought partners, whether that is remotely or sitting next to you in the next classroom. You know, you deserve to have other people who are thinking about this too, who can be like their own reading teacher's lounge, right? And have these conversations, because you certainly don't need to do it alone. So if you want to talk about it with me, feel free. You can find me on all the socials. I'm on Twitter as Linda Schultze, because that's my maiden name was Schultz. I'm on Instagram under my business name, Linda Ryan Consulting, which is the same for Facebook. That's my website is lindaryanconsulting.com. I'm on LinkedIn. I will always have a conversation, as the ladies here will tell you. I'm happy to have conversations, to do voice texts back and forth. I love talking about this stuff because it's my own journey. It's my own experience as a parent with a child who's learning to read. And I don't want my story to continue to be other teachers' stories.
Thank you so much. We'll also make sure that we have the links to all your social media accounts too in our show notes. But it was a joy and a pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.